This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Guy Raz. Steve Jobs, the founder of Apple, has died. He'd been battling pancreatic cancer for years.
The iPhone, the iPod, the iMac, the iPad.
It boggles the mind to think about all the things that Steve Jobs did.
Roger McNamee worked with Jobs on several projects. He says Jobs brought us desktop publishing, computer animated movies, the first commercially successful computer.
Any one of which would have qualified him as one of the great executives in American history, the sum of which put him in a place where no one else has ever been before.
And Jobs was as much a great executive as he was an inventor.
To me, he is of his era what Thomas Edison was to the beginning of the 20th century.
Steve Jobs was just 21 when he founded Apple Computer in his garage in Cupertino, California. In 1977, when Jobs and his partner Steve Wozniak released the Apple II, most computers were big enough to fill a university basement or were do-it-yourself kits for hobbyists with soldering irons.
The Apple II was a huge hit.
Leander Caney is the author of Inside Steve Jobs' Brain.
That was really the first blockbuster PC that anyone had seen, and it made Apple the biggest computer manufacturer in the nascent computer industry.
The Apple II had sound, and it was the only computer on the market with color graphics. You could hook it up to your TV set and play games on it. It also had a spreadsheet program that made it popular with small businesses. But in 1981, Apple got some serious competition when IBM released its first personal computer. IBM had the advantage of its well-known trusted name. Apple countered with the Macintosh. The Mac's signature was that it was easy to use. The Mac was an example of the kind of product that would define Steve Jobs' entire career. Author Caney.
Jobs' idea was that we'll make it easy enough that anybody can do it, a grandmother, a kid, you know, people who don't have any experience.
With the Mac, Steve Jobs introduced the first computer to the public that had a mouse and graphical user interface, pull-down menus and icons. Jobs, a California boy, loathed the kind of conformist East Coast culture represented by IBM. In 1984, when he released the Mac, Jobs sent that message to millions with one of the most famous television commercials of all time. The ad aired once during the Super Bowl. The minute-long commercial referenced George Orwell's 1984. A woman dressed in bright-colored shorts runs into a room of gray-looking people and throws an anvil at a screen where Big Brother, read IBM, is talking.
On January 24th, Apple Computer will introduce Macintosh. And you'll see why 1984 won't be like 1984.
Jobs said computers were tools to unleash human creativity.
Part of what made the Macintosh great was that the people working on it were musicians and poets and artists and zoologists and historians who also happened to be the best computer scientists in the world.
That's Jobs in the 1996 PBS documentary Triumph of the Nerds. In many ways, Steve Jobs was the poet of the computer world. He'd gone to India and become a Buddhist. He took LSD and believed it had opened his mind to new ways of thinking. But Jobs' iconoclastic ideals did not always make him easy to work with. Trip Hawkins was the marketing director of Apple until 1982.
He was just a terrible manager and a terrible executive. And at that point in time, I really never thought that he could be a CEO.
In fact, in a boardroom coup, the man that Jobs hired to be CEO of his company, John Sculley, got him fired in 1985. But Jobs was still driven to make computers vehicles for creativity. After he left Apple, Jobs purchased a little-known division of Lucasfilm and renamed it Pixar. In 1995, Pixar released the first animated feature to be done entirely on computers, Toy Story. It's about the secret life of toys like Slinkies and a talking cowboy doll.
Slink.
Oh, well, all right. You can be right if you want.
Not now, Slink. I got some bad news.
Bad news?
Toy Story was a major hit, and Pixar followed it with other big hits, Bug's Life, The Incredibles, Cars. But in the years since Jobs had left Apple, the company had gotten into trouble. It had less than 5% of the computer market, and most analysts predicted its demise. The board invited Jobs to come back and run his old company. In 1998, Jobs introduced the iMac. Venture capitalist Roger McNamee says once again Jobs helped remake the computer industry. The iMac was the first computer made to harness the creative potential of the Internet.
The transition of consumers from passive consumption of content to active creation of entertainment, so that people write their own blogs, they make their own digital photographs, they make their own movies, and Apple made all the tools to make that easy, and they did it at a time when Microsoft just wasn't paying attention.
Jobs next set his sights on the music industry.
This is not a speculative market, and because it's a part of everyone's life, it's a very large target market all around the world.
There were MP3 players on the market, but none of them were easy to use. Jobs helped engineer the iPod, which he introduced at a trade show in San Francisco in 2001.
This amazing little device holds 1,000 songs, and it goes right in my pocket.
The iPod was a classic Jobs product, easy to use and nice to look at. Apple sold tens of millions of iPods. The iTunes store became the number one retailer. 6 years later, Apple released the iPhone. Again, there had been other devices that put a phone and a music player together, but none of them were as elegant and easy to use. Susan Rockrise, a creative director who worked with Jobs in the late 1980s and early 1990s, says that was Jobs' signature.
Simplifying complexity is not simple. It is the greatest, greatest gift to have someone who has Steve's capabilities as an editor and a product designer edit the crap away so that you can focus on what you want to do.
Jobs' last game changer was the iPad. For years, the computer industry had tried but failed to find a formula for slate computers. And for years, people had been talking about ebooks. But it wasn't until Apple entered the market with the iPad that the promise of slate computers and ebooks came together. Rockrise believes Steve Jobs has touched every person who clicks a mouse, sends a photo from their desktop to the internet, publishes a book at home on their computer, enjoys portable music, or a computer animated movie. Laura Seidel, NPR News, San Francisco.
Steve Jobs, founder of Apple, has died. He'd been battling pancreatic cancer for years.
Amazon upped its stakes in the technology world, finally confirming it will sell a tablet computer. It's called the Kindle Fire. It has a color screen and can play movies, TV shows, and music. The Fire enters a market that's been dominated by Apple, which of course has sold about 29 million iPads. But unlike other challengers to Apple, Amazon has lots of content to sell. NPR's Laura Seidel reports.
Before Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos announced the Kindle Fire, he showed off Amazon's growing assortment of entertainment content. Its Prime service offers all kinds of streaming TV and movies for $79 a year.
And we've had great participation from networks and studios, many of them, and I'm just going to, and we're just getting started.
It's Arrested Development.
The latest edition was Fox, with shows like Arrested Development and Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
And we asked ourselves, is there some way that we can bring all of these things together into a remarkable product offering that customers would love?
And Bezos said the answer was that they could. He introduced the Kindle Fire. It's smaller than an iPad, 7 inches versus about 10, so you can hold it in one hand. And it connects to the internet with Wi-Fi, no 3G version. Bezos streamed the film X-Men and showed off the full color screen.
16 million colors. pixels per inch. Gorilla Glass.
It all sounds pretty grand, but
there's no 3G, there's no Bluetooth, there's no camera, there's no microphone.
That's Michael Gartenberg from Gartner, a research firm. He says the Kindle Fire is no iPad. Gartenberg says a lot of people will take an iPad instead of a laptop and maybe hook up a keyboard to it so they can get some work done. The Kindle Fire is too small for that, but it's great for watching movies, reading, and so forth.
So for consumers, consumer that's only looking for content consumption, not creation, this is going to be a device of choice. Or for the consumer who wanted to buy an iPad but couldn't justify a $500 purchase.
Which leads us to the price. Amazon is offering the Kindle Fire for $199, and that is why Rob Enderle, an analyst with the Enderle Group, thinks a lot of people are going to buy the Fire rather than splurge on an iPad.
The Fire and the iPad overlap significantly, so it is undoubtedly going to be a one or the other decision this year.
Enderle says his studies show that consumers are 10 times more likely to buy something that sells for $200 than they are to pay more than $500 for something. Add to that Amazon's other new options. It unveiled two touchscreen Kindles just for reading, and now it sells its low-end Kindle for $79. So, if you're out doing your Christmas shopping, you can buy Dad a Kindle Fire and Junior a Kindle e-reader for less than $300 total. Of course, Enderle believes Apple is watching closely.
You're running against Apple, and Apple is no normal vendor, and they're clearly going to respond to this threat.
So, we could be about to enter a tablet war. And that, say most analysts, might be hard on some CEOs. However, it might bring down prices even more, or at least get us tablets with even more cool features. Laura Seidel, NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Alyssa Block.
And I'm Michelle Norris. Right now, armies of marketers, pollsters, and social scientists are trying to figure out what Americans think about everything from global warming to Lady Gaga's latest outfit. Surveys are only so good. It's hard getting a big enough sample to be sure of the results, and that's particularly vexing for social scientists who want a high standard of accuracy. Well, now they have a new window to the world, Twitter. NPR's Christopher Joyce reports on recent efforts by researchers to get tweets to do their work for them.
Normally, if social scientists wanted to design an experiment on, say, how people's moods change during the course of a day, they'd recruit some of their students. But statistically, what 50 college kids do really doesn't reflect the American public. Scientists need lots of people to make solid conclusions about human behavior. That's why Scott Golder went to Twitter, where millions and millions of people express themselves daily.
This is the stuff of social life. Whether you're doing that with diaries from a few hundred years ago or you're doing it with the tweets of today, you're still looking into the personal lives of regular people, and that is very revealing.
What Golder and his colleagues at Cornell University wanted revealed is how do people's moods go up and down, positive or negative, through the day and the week. That might then reveal how much and when your biorhythms or your environment control the way you feel. They used a common computer program that scans text for key words in tweets that reflect the writer's mood, or as psychologists call it, affect, such as
aching, afraid, cynical, fear, mad, fury.
In a word, negative. As for the positive side,
things like agree, definitely, fine, outgoing, paradise, pleasing.
And of course, this being the Twitter generation.
Awesome. Awesome is an awesome word.
Golder is a graduate student in social and computer science. His team spent months scanning tweets by over 2 million people in 84 countries, half a billion tweets. Here's what they found.
We found that there are two peaks in positive affect during the day. One occurs first thing in the morning, and the other occurs late at night.
But of course, you say, the dip in the middle is when you go to work. Golder says no.
The shape of the rhythm, or when it peaks and when it valleys, is the same on the weekend as during the week.
Golder doesn't know why mornings and evenings tend to be brighter than the rest of the day. A night's sleep could explain the morning bump up. Biochemicals associated with a person's circadian rhythms could also be at work. And certainly what happens to you during a day would have an effect. While the results might not be terribly surprising, they point to a new social media wave in academic research. David Lazar is a practitioner of both political and computer science at Northeastern University.
We've really been in flat Earth all these years, and suddenly we've discovered there's a third dimension.
Lazar notes that tweets are public, but he adds that academic institutions should be writing up ethics standards for the use of data from social media. And he says scientists should be careful about what they conclude from that data.
I mean, these are not scientifically designed instruments to collect data under pristine circumstances. It's often difficult to tell what's causing what.
But Twitter certainly can reveal people's views. Kent Cavender-Bears is an environmental scientist at the University of Minnesota.
I see it as a great way to get a pulse of what's going on.
He says you still need people to double-check computerized language scanners. Computers don't recognize sarcasm, or some words with more than one meaning, like blizzards.
Real quickly, you find out that a lot of people are tweeting about Dairy Queen blizzards, an ice cream, rather than a snowstorm.
The Cornell research appears in the journal Science. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
Up next, Flora Lichtman is here with our video pick of the week. Hi, Flora.
Hi, Ira.
What have you got going for us today?
We are not in your backyard. This is a home tour that, like, you've never seen before,
I'm pretty sure.
We go to Long Island, Calverton, Long Island, which is near Riverhead, and visit Kevin Shea, who built himself a geodesic dome to live in. This dome is a home.
A dome home. And he built it out of a kit, is that right?
Yeah, he built it out of a kit. So he's
sent away.
In 1993, he says, he was thumbing through Popular Science magazine, and he gets to the back, and there are these ads in the back, and he sees an ad for a geodesic dome kit.
Right.
And for $11,000, you can build a dome that is 44 feet tall, 70 feet in diameter, and that's like 93,000 cubic feet. It's
huge.
It's very hard to get a sense of the scale until you actually see him climb the rope that he has going from the floor to the ceiling in the middle of the dome, which you can see on our website.
At Science Friday. Go up to our website for a video pick of the week at sciencefriday.com. His neighbors were not very happy.
His neighbors were not happy. I mean, the best part is we drive in with Kevin down his driveway, and before we turn in, it looks like regular sort of white picket fence suburbia. And then you get to his driveway, and it's this kind of mushroom-shaped, forest green, windowless, from the back anyway, dome. And they were, you know, this house does not belong here, was the vibe from the neighbors.
And he's also made it very energy efficient, right?
I mean, Kevin Shea amazed me. He takes green to another level. So we've got here a solar array, a wind turbine, geothermal system inside. He's brewing biodiesel in a shed in the backyard. There wasn't even time to get into that.
Wow.
And then, you know, just he reuses materials. He's got a garden made of 800 tires, and fiber optic cable is crushed up and turned into an artificial lake. He's really come up with these neat solutions. And neat uses of stuff.
And unless you think he was some science-y geek, he was a firefighter for 20 years, right?
Yeah,
New York City firefighter?
This is the makings of a full-length feature, I think. But he's a firefighter in New York City and was injured in 9/11 and so ended up retiring. And actually, his firefighter buddies helped him build this. And he said, you know, the interesting thing about getting a kit for a geodesic dome is it's made of these triangles, right? So if any of the wood is slightly off, warped, you have a big problem once you get around to the other end of the circle.
Oh, yeah, I'm thinking about this.
So they have, like, tons of people sort of pulling things in line. It sounded like a really dramatic construction
process.
You need
a lot of buddies
to
help out on this.
And a lot of strong firefighters, it sounds like.
And it's beautiful because you have all that inside space that's open to work with, right?
It's huge.
It's
like living in the Omnimax. I mean, it's just this kind of really, really open space. And he uses it he's got a swing inside.
That's right. You could swing from side to side.
Which he does.
Yeah. You can see all of this in our video pick of the week. It's Flora Lichtman's got it up there on our website at sciencefriday.com. You can also download it on podcast it on iTunes, and it's up there on the left side. And this guy, you see him swinging on his rope, climbing up the roof.
It's worth watching. And also, I'm looking for other people who are living in sort of unconventional homes and doing things in a DIY green way, because Kevin really has figured out how to do this on his own.
Right.
So if you know of anybody, shoot me an email. I put my email address on our website. By the video.
And you asked a couple of weeks ago for mushroom pictures, right? And we got all kinds of mushrooms.
The mushroom pictures have flooded in. Check out the Facebook page. They're really beautiful, and we've got long sort of threads going on about what they are. I can't identify them, but our listeners are doing a good job.
All right, Flora Lichtman, our video pick of the week. That's about all the time we have for today. Our program senior producer is Annette Heist. Charles Berquist is our director. Flora Lichtman is our multimedia editor. Our producers are Christopher Taliata, Leshu Bayak. Sam Flato was our production assistant. Our intern intern is Francie Deep. Neil Rausch is our technical director. Manoli Weatherall spinning the controls here today in New York. And if you missed any part of our program, go to iTunes, subscribe to our podcast, audio and video. And you want to see this video pick of the week, go to our website at sciencefriday.com. And you can send us, maybe you have some photos of your dome, still taking those mushroom pictures and looking to post them up on our Facebook page. And you can join our growing Facebook community and our Twitter community. And we can all join each other on our homepage at sciencefriday.com. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Alyssa Block.
And I'm Michelle Norris. In so many ways, the Internet has shoved aside old-fashioned letters, the kind written on stationery or at letterhead. Email, texting, Twitter, Skype, and social media have also overshadowed faxes, postcards, and telegrams. But there's a website that serves as a bridge between the new technology and the old. It's called lettersofnote.com. On it, you can see and read correspondence written or received by people whose names you know. Marilyn Monroe, Elvis Presley, Bruce Springsteen, Charles Darwin, John F. Kennedy, and the list goes on and on. Sean Usher came up with the idea for Letters of Note, and he joins me now from Manchester, England. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on.
Where do all these letters come from? I look at the site almost every day, and I'm always amazed at the stuff that seems to come in over your transom.
The majority come in from, they're already on the internet. I mean, there's so many archives on the internet, but they're not very accessible to the layperson. So it's just a matter of navigating these educational websites to find the gold, as it were.
Well, let's mine through some of this gold. Let's tick through some of the letters. And I want to begin with a letter that's just so sweet. It's written by JFK, and he's asking his father for a raise.
That's one of my favorites, actually. That was in 1927. I think he was 10 years old. You can see the effort he's put into writing it. Like, literally, you can see the shaky handwriting. If I could read the whole thing, if you'd like.
Oh, let's hear it.
Dedicated to my Mr. J.P. Kennedy. My recent allowance is 40 cents. This I used for aeroplanes and other playthings of childhood. But now I'm a scout and I put away my childish things. Before I would spend 20 cents of my 40 cents allowance, and in 5 minutes I would have empty pockets and nothing to gain and 20 cents to lose. When I, a scout, I have to buy canteens, haversacks, blankets, searchlegs, poncho things that will last for years, and I can always use it while I can't use a chocolate marshmallow sundae with vanilla ice cream. And so I put in my plea for a raise of 30 cents for me to buy scout things and pay my own way more around. Finney, John Fitzgerald, Francis Kennedy.
And you know that he got that raise in his allowance. How could you say no?
You couldn't say no to that.
Some of these letters take you deep inside the world of the people who wrote them or the people who received them. I was struck by the correspondence that you have, either to or written by Marilyn Monroe, in particular a letter that she received just after she had admitted herself for psychiatric treatment.
Yeah, there's quite a few Marilyn Monroe letters. But yeah, this particular one, Marlon Brando wrote to her, basically telling her to stay strong while she was in the institute. It's a tragic thing to read, especially now knowing how she ended up. But that's one of the great things about this site. It's a whole range of emotions you go through reading these letters.
There's also a wonderful letter about receiving champagne from a German, where you see a much more playful and coquettish Marilyn Monroe.
To be honest, I don't know much about it. It was written to a member of the German consulate. It simply says, "Dear Mr. von Fusseldorf, thank you for your champagne. It arrived, I drank it, and I was gayer. Thanks again, my best Marilyn Monroe." And that's it. So simple, but it's just Marilyn Monroe.
I love the love letter from Johnny Cash to June Carter Cash.
That's beautiful.
Isn't that lovely?
Mm.
It's a short letter that reads, "You got away with words and away with me as well." He writes like he's writing a song. You can almost hear him singing this. "The fire and excitement may be gone now that we don't go out there and sing them anymore, but the ring of fire still burns around you and I, keeping our love hotter than a pepper sprout. Love, John."
Amazing. Amazing.
"Thanks for the dream." What's that letter about?
"Thanks for the dream" is a letter from Roald Dahl, a little girl. She'd been reading the BFG. It was her favourite book. And in the BFG, they bottle up dreams. So she decided to make her own out of glitter and a little bottle and some oil. And her dad helped her to make this little bottle. And she sent it to Roald Dahl and said, "Here's one of my dreams for you." really lovely. So he wrote back and he said, thanks very much for your dream. I'll go into town later tonight and blow it into the rooms of some children.
Yeah, tonight I shall go down to the village and blow it through the bedroom window of some sleeping child and see if it works.
Just lovely. Perfect reply.
Do you do this in part to help keep the art of letter writing alive, to help people understand that it really is an art, to actually write something down as opposed to just pounding out a message via email?
Yes, but to be honest, I would be quite a hypocrite if I said that too much, because personally, I've not written letters for quite a few years. The last letter I wrote was a complaint letter. Not the nicest. I just haven't got the time. But there is a glimmer of hope. I think there will always be people that will write letters. Some people will just never come round to using technology like the internet. But if there is a part of it that touches people in that kind of way and reminds them that letter writing is indeed an art and should be carried on, then that's got to be a good thing.
I've been talking to Sean Usher. He's the editor of Letters of Note. That's an online archive of correspondence. He's currently compiling a book about the project. Sean, it's been great to talk to you. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
For 2,000 years, the Dead Sea Scrolls were seen by no one. Today, they can be viewed by anyone with access to the internet. Google and the Israel Museum in Jerusalem teamed up to put high-quality images of the scrolls online. Images of the relics, the oldest known copies of biblical text, went live on the web last week. John Stokes writes about technology for Wired.com. He is also a scholar of biblical history, and he joins us from KALW in San Francisco. John Stokes, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Now, the scrolls may be new to the web, but they were discovered in 1947, and historical scholars have had access to copies and translations for decades. I mean, what's the big deal about having them online now?
So there's a long and kind of sordid and really interesting publication history behind the scrolls, because if you're a scholar and you dig something up out of the ground that's brand new, or you're assigned to work on something that hasn't been discovered, you might take, you know, a decade to publish this, to really get it in shape to publish it, because this is your career. I mean, this is going to be your piece of immortality. You're going to be the guy that did the first critical edition of the Dead Sea Scrolls, you know, Isaiah scroll or what have you. And so there was fierce scholarly competition, and the work just dragged on and on and on. And scholars got really frustrated at the delays, the wider scholarly community, because they said, hey, you know, this is a once in a generation kind of find. And it's been, you know, 20 years and we haven't had access to this, especially not in the way that we want. So when I was in grad school, there would be a special day in the semester and everybody would get excited because we would get to go and have an in-person look at some of the manuscripts that were in the University of Chicago's collection or in Harvard's collection. And, you know, the students would sit and these things would be laid out for us and we wouldn't be able to touch them and you could look at them with a magnifying glass. But that was like, you know, once or twice in my life that happens. Most scholars are lucky if you're able to just get your hands on a really good, high-quality color copy of a text that you're working on. So now this thing is just, it's been put online and anyone, you know, if my daughter, you know, God forbid, decides to follow in my footsteps and try to become a humanities scholar or a historian, she'll have grown up in a world where she can get really, really close to these manuscripts in a way that almost nobody could.
How close will you be able to get? And, I'm trying to imagine, what will the scrolls look like online? Will you be able to zoom in on the material the way you can, like Google Earth? Or
yeah, that's correct. So these were photographed at a 1,200 megapixel resolution. You know, so you know, if you think about an 8 megapixel camera, I mean, this is, you know, 10x that or better. And so you can scroll up and see the fibers, you know, and the particles in the manuscript.
John, you're a biblical scholar, so I have to ask: have you gone online and looked at the Dead Sea Scrolls, and are you excited about the possibilities of what it means for your own work?
Absolutely, absolutely. These are searchable. You know, I can actually search these, you know, by English translation. You know, I can go to a specific verse or a specific phrase, and I can zoom in, and I can attach comments to it. But yeah, I mean, it's definitely the kind of tool that scholars need.
So it's not the same as actually getting to touch it, but it's the closest any of us are going to get.
It's almost better. I mean, I've seen these things in person, and you know, you look at them with a magnifying glass, and it's almost better to be able to do the kind of really, really high level zoom in, and that's going to be incredible.
John Stokes is a technology writer and biblical scholar. He joins us from KALW in San Francisco. John Stokes, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.